Well, welcome to everybody to Narkeith Bible Study. It is the 21st of October, 2017, and we're looking at the triennial parasha, so a very slowed down pace of reading through the first five books of the Bible. Downstairs this morning, we'll be jumping ahead, which in this sense is jumping back to Genesis, but right now we are in Leviticus. And from sources in the Cairo Geniza, people have been able to put together this reading with Isaiah 57:17. So that means someone around Jesus' day saw a connection between these two scriptures. And as was the custom, we know in the Nazareth synagogue, when they handed Jesus the scroll, it was his responsibility then to link the passages you're reading in the Torah up with something in the prophets. Like you have a full dinner and then you have a dessert. So his job was to bring the dessert. And of course, Jesus read from Isaiah 61 and said, "This is fulfilled right now as you're hearing." Very big and wonderful claim. So our job this morning will be not just to mull over these two passages, but to try to figure out why someone saw these two as complementing each other. What is the connection? So I'll just start us off with some prayer, and then we'll dig into the texts. Lord God, thank you for bringing us all here this morning. For each person, thank you for your Shabbat. Thank you that you're able to work with us and in us despite ourselves. And we ask that you would be with our thoughts and inspire our spirits as we read these texts. Let us understand you better. Let us see something new this morning. And be with us the rest of the worship service as well. In Jesus' name we ask. Amen.
Amen.
So, as is our custom, we'll start by reading the first text out of Leviticus. We're in chapter 13. We have a rather short selection, verses 18 through 28. And as you'll see, it's in the middle of rules, basically, about clean and unclean, ceremonial cleanliness and uncleanliness, and as it relates specifically to skin diseases. So not normally a text many people dig into, because it takes more energy to try to find an application to our world today. Okay, so Gemma, I guess you'll start us off, and we can each person can take a verse, and we'll go around until we run out of verses.
Well, my verse ends with a comma, so I'm going to cheat and read.
Okay,
two.
You may read.
When
two,
the
then.
Body has a boil on its skin and it is healed, but in the place of a boil there is a white swelling or a bright reddish-white spot, then it should be shown to the Kohen.
And if, when the priest sees it, it indeed appears deeper than the skin, and its hair has turned white, the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It is a leprous sore which has broken out of the boil.
But if the Kohen looks at it and doesn't see any white hairs in it, and it isn't more than skin deep, but appears faded, the Kohen is to isolate him for 7 days.
And if it spreads in the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It is a disease.
But if the bright spot stays in its place and has not spread, it is the scar of the boil, so the priest is to pronounce him clean.
If anyone has a burn on his skin, and the raw flesh of the burn turns into a pink or bright white area,
then the priest shall examine it, and indeed, if the hair of the bright spot is turned white, and it appears deeper than the skin, and is a leprosy broken out in the burn, then the priest shall pronounce him unclean. It is a leprous sore.
But if the priest looks at it, and indeed there are no white hairs in the bright spot, and it is not deeper than the skin, but has faded, then the priest shall isolate him 7 days.
And the priest shall examine him on the seventh day. If it has at all spread over the skin, then the priest shall pronounce him
28. That's right. Saved by the bell. Interesting selection, yes? Would you like to be a priest? It's interesting when we think of priest, we think of, well, what do you think of normally?
Somebody.
You think of Roman Catholic? Well, when you think, okay, let's say, when you think of the biblical priest, what do you tend to think of first?
Between a man and God?
Sacrifices, yeah.
Being very clean in the temple.
Being very clean in the temple.
The priestly rota.
The rota, how it exchanges, or they have a very scheduled system of who serves. Of course, that you could say is a development over time.
There was a responsibility. I mean, he's responsible really for standing before God.
He's responsible for standing before God. One of his jobs is to also be doctor, basically. He has to decide, to determine between clean and unclean, and to teach the people between clean and unclean. And as we've discussed in these Bible studies previously, clean and unclean, it's part of the whole temple system. So we're talking about ceremonial cleanness. What is considered pure to be able to come into the temple, and what is impure that stays out of the temple and away from any holy objects? Of course, we have to always point out, because this isn't part of our worldview today, clean and unclean are not, don't automatically relate to sin and non-sin. Right? So to be unclean is not a sin. It can't be. Jesus was unclean. To stay in uncleanliness and not go through the directions as prescribed here would be sin, not to deal with it. But just to be unclean, well, that's part of the human condition. In fact, I would argue most people, most of the time, are unclean. The rarity is to actually be clean. And that's why as you're trying to prepare yourself to go to the temple, that's when you would do a mikveh or whatever to prepare yourself. So here it's very technical. We're talking about specifically skin things. I was listening to many of your translations.
Yeah.
It's interesting. We've talked about the greater skin and skin diseases. And now we're dealing with the shechin, which, do any of you recognize that word? Shechin?
Shechina?
No, that's a different. It's with a het, shechin. If you do the Passover in Hebrew, you have to put a drop of wine for each of the plagues. One of them is shechin, shechinin, which are boils, or translated boils. So that's this word shechin, some type of boil here.
How do you spell boil, shechin?
Shin, het, yud, nun.
Het, yud, nun.
Okay, and there are different types of diseases we're dealing with. Nega, which is also interesting, that connects us to the 10 plagues. That's from verse 17 previously. So the priest's job is to determine whether this skin disease, when it is clean and when it is unclean, and it seems to be when it has changed to a certain pattern that looks like it's healing or constant, it's clean. If it looks like it's open and fresh, it's considered unclean, and then you have different amounts of time to wait and reevaluate. So you give it a week and you reevaluate it.
Strictly for clean and unclean, right? Not for healing. You're
well,
it's not really, because it's only look at it outside 7 days.
You're saying the priest has no function in helping it heal, right? Is that what you're saying?
It was strange to read, but it's very diagnostic. You know, like if you read a medical journal, you'd read like this. Strange.
Diagnostic?
But,
yeah.
But not put this on it.
Right.
So it's diagnostic, not therapeutic.
Yeah. So it's simply, you're right, because a priest's job is to keep those two things apart. Keep the impure away from the pure.
Not
so... it's really just a question of when you're clean or unclean. He's not actually helping you get to either of those destinations.
I don't want to interrupt, but I think you should say something very briefly about why clean and unclean is not related to sin. You actually said Jesus was unclean just now, and
sure.
I'm prepared to bet that they're quite worried about that.
Yes, I did worry. I did.
You worried about Jesus being unclean?
Yeah.
Well, the process of birth, anything that touches birth blood will be unclean. So Jesus, by nature of being human and being born, is then unclean. If you remember, Mary brought what was directed in the law, two pigeons, as a purity or purifying offering. And at that point, or before, I don't know about the baby, but for the woman, at that point, she would be clean.
And we as Protestants have conflated the two concepts of clean and unclean.
Right. And not, I would argue not just as Protestants, because as we read through the prophets, I think this becomes a nice metaphor. Because you have this operating in the physical realm, and you can see an open sore, and okay, when you have an open sore, you're not allowed to go in the temple. It becomes this nice metaphor for being separated from God because of a problem. And because it makes such a nice metaphor for sin, they're used. It doesn't mean that physically having a sore means you're sinful. You see the difference? But it does become a nice metaphor for it. And so it's easy for us then, because we're not doing sacrifices, we don't even see the physical reality anymore, to jump directly to the metaphor. Yeah. But certainly, I mean, God commanded be fruitful and multiply. And yet, every part of that physical process will make you unclean. But it's a blessing. So God wouldn't command you to sin. It's just part of a human nature that is connected to mortality, I would say, and carries with it something other than God. And so holy, when you're setting up a temple, what is holy and dedicated to God? You want the life-giving, the immortal. And so there was a system that set up to separate between the two spheres.
Even the word unclean sounds negative. It sounds like dirty. Dirty
right.
Sounds like bad. But this is something that is sacred and just not sacred. Regular is
right.
Not
sacred and regular.
Regular is not necessarily negative.
Not necessarily bad. Right.
In most cases, I think you can trace things to do with uncleanness to death in one
sure.
form or another.
Yeah.
And this is something that God did not choose for us.
Right.
We chose it. And he wants to continually separate himself and make a distinction. Anything that looks like or touches or leads to death
right.
is unclean.
As a broad concept, that seems to cover many of the uncleanness. There are particular points where you kind of have to fit it in. But priests... The priestly worldview is very clear, you know, and very black and white. So even those little things, if there's something borderline, okay, well, the camel chews cud, but it doesn't have a split hoof, so he's in this category. So there are little things that were lying on the line, and they just put in one or the other. But in general, I'd agree with you. It has to do with death, things connected to death, or I'd almost say mortality. Because, of course, childbirth, we connect to life. But the fact that there is childbirth is because we're mortal. If we weren't mortal, we wouldn't need children, really. So there's that whole thing. Okay, so back to...
Sorry about that, but I just thought it was important.
Yeah. So we have this boil, and the priest has to decide between white swellings and all the technical vocabulary. Of course, we have to come at and try to figure out that swelling word. It's not always clear what it means, because within this white swelling, it says if it's sunken in. So what, there's a swelling and then it's sunken in? Or how does that work? Or is this word se'et, is it something other than swelling in this context? It's literally a lifting up, or a carrying. So many little things here to question. And vaheret. Baheret comes from the word to be bright. That's what a lot of your translations are translating as a bright spot.
Yeah,
that's also
white. Reddish white spot.
Uh huh.
But what about.
You can think of maybe something infectious. The other big thing to think about, okay, I was just talking some about the terminology in verse 19. One of the keys is understanding if it's a negatzara'at, which historically has been translated leprosy. Does anyone have leprosy in your Bible here? I heard one person, a leprous.
I got sa'arat.
Okay. So historically it was translated leprosy. Everybody acknowledges that it is not actually leprosy, as in Hansen's disease, what we call leprosy today, but it is some type of skin disease. And the question is it a specific name of a particular skin disease, or is it just skin disease in general? And it's unclear, because what the priest is testing is to see if it's this sara'at, this skin disease, and if it is, the person's unclean. But it seems to imply that you can actually recover from sara'at. You wouldn't necessarily have what I'm calling, quote, leprosy forever. So it's not Hansen's disease, but it could actually be any skin disease that is infectious. I think that's the idea behind it. That's why you would quarantine it. And
where does it say, I don't know if it's in this passage, that the real, quotes, leper, the Hansen disease, is beyond the pale and outside? I mean, you get it in the New Testament all the time.
It doesn't actually say.
Is it here?
No, it's not here. I mean, we could do a study on what is translated as leprosy in the New Testament and then see. It's certainly treated as, you know, stay away from me. It is treated as very tameh, very unclean, and so you need to be separated. But I don't know if even in the New Testament it's treated as incurable. Of course, if it's a broad category of infectious skin diseases, it would include what we call leprosy today as well then, which in most cases for people without antibiotics is incurable. It is actually curable to us today. But
it isn't describing, you know, limbs gone and all kinds of stuff like that. It's very preliminary.
Right. Well, what I'm saying is it could include that because it's broad, but it wouldn't be restricted to that.
Yeah, because when you get the 10 lepers, they come to Yeshua, and he says, go and show yourself to the priest. And as they go, as they're obedient to go, these people who are presumably unclean and on the outside, they are healed. So one doesn't know whether the term, these 10 lepers, were really Hansen's disease, which is really quite nasty in those days.
Right, right. So we'll leave that for now, because it doesn't directly relate, except that our term, sara'at, would be a huge infectious skin disease category that would presumably include Hansen's disease, but certainly is not limited to it. I mean, you remember Uzziahu, the king of Judah?
Yeah.
Whatever disease he had until he died. So once he got it, if you read in 2 Chronicles 26, his story, he got it by going into the temple and usurping the role of the priest. And so it broke out from the moment he was extending his incense pan, which is the priest's job to do incense. It says sara'at broke out on his forehead, and so they immediately rushed him out of the temple so that he wouldn't make anything unclean. And I guess at that point, it's interesting because they use the same word to break out here, lifroach, to blossom,
in
verse 20.
Miriam?
Also Miriam got sara'at kasheleg, as like snow.
Like snow.
Right, so something white. But if you're reading through this passage, in verse 20, what makes it unclean? Its appearance is like what?
Lower than the skin.
Okay, lower than the skin.
And its hair has turned white.
And his hair has turned white. And then that's when he, literally in Hebrew it says, the priest will make him impure. But the sense is he will pronounce him impure. Because this is a negatzara'at. Okay, so I'm going to just put this here, Shafai. Lower. And white hair. And this makes impure or unclean, in ceremonially unclean. Okay. Contrasted to that, in verse 21, if it doesn't have a white hair, and there is no depression or lower than the skin, and it's dark, then what should the priest do?
Put him in isolation.
Put in isolation.
7 days.
7 days. And then recheck. And then when you recheck, if it's spread, then he determines it unclean. But if it's not, then it's clean.
But if you're isolated for 7 days, are you by definition unclean?
During that time?
Time, yes.
Yeah, you're isolated.
I think so.
Probably. In practicality, you are, because you're not going in the temple.
Right.
And you're not touching other people.
Right.
So you're contained. So yeah, whatever status you are. What?
And you have to wash your clothes afterwards.
And you have to wash your clothes.
You're pronounced clean.
That's right. That's true. There's a washing of the clothes, and then you are either clean or unclean. Okay, so it seems to be in these two particular cases in our selection, whether it is a shchin, a boil, or whether it's a burn, what is the thing that makes it unclean? What's a common denominator? What?
Irritation of
a white
skin.
Hair and
deeper than, skin, skin.
Deeper than the skin. That's right. So
it's funny because a boil is above the skin.
Yeah, it's raised up.
Well, that's what I was saying in the first place, that it's hard to understand some of this terminology, because also se'et means a rising, right? A swelling. So then how is it deeper than the other skin? But maybe within the swelling there's a depression. I think when things are actively inflamed, you won't find any part of it depressed.
Right.
But I'm not, I don't have a degree in medicine.
My translation says more than skin deep, which could just be referring to thickness.
Wait, more than skin deep?
More than skin deep, rather
right.
than lower than skin.
So they're just again referring, there's two words I use in our selection. One is shafal and one is amok, which is deep. But it seems to be describing the same thing. So more than skin deep. So this is, yeah, so that is the other interpretation, that when your infection, it's swelling on top, but when you press it, it seems to be way underneath as well. So a serious internal infection, I mean, going deeper and not just right on the top. I don't know. It's hard to say from this vantage point much later in history. I would like to travel back in time and ask the priest, wait, what is exactly this?
It looks to me like this passage refers to distinguishing between a burn and an infectious disease.
Well, between both. You have two examples. I mean, a boil is, in some senses, already an infection. Mm-hmm. But there's some type of category that would be either an active infection or a secondary infection that could also be in a burn. And when you see that, you're unclean.
Well, the burn would be darker.
The burn would be darker.
Well, that's what it says here. If it's,
in either case, if it gets darker and then there's this lower depression, then it's termed pure, which means it's probably healing. Okay. One thing I have to point out that, of course, our passage isn't connected to because they didn't have the New Testament yet, but what passage in the New Testament does this remind you of? Besides not connecting it to leprosy, but the whole other things in the context. The whole distinguishing thing, right? You're looking for a depression and a white hair. Or the lack of a white hair, a dark hair.
What in the New Testament?
What in the New Testament? And then
fruits, I mean, that's
You're jumping metaphors? Okay. I'll tell you what I immediately think about. I think about Matthew 5:34. Did I get it right? Yes. In the context of vows, in Matthew, Jesus is interpreting the law. And he goes through some of these big laws and he says, you've heard that it's said, but I tell you this. So in Matthew 5:33, again, you have heard that it was said to an older generation, do not break an oath, but fulfill your vows to the Lord. But I say to you, do not take oaths at all. Not by heaven, because it is the throne of God. That's, where is that from? Jeremiah 3:1, I think. Heaven is my seat. Not by earth, because it is his footstool. You can find that in the Psalms. And not by Jerusalem, because it is the city of the great king. And where is that from? Jeremiah or Isaiah? So it's beautiful interpretation he's got there. He's giving a proof text without quoting it for each of these things that you're not supposed to swear by. And then he says, do not take an oath by your head. I guess another thing people would swear by. Because you are not able to make one hair white or black. Let your word be yes, yes. Let your word be yes, yes, or no, no. More than this is from the evil one. So here, if you don't have the context of Leviticus, you may jump to old age, right? White or black. But I think he's actually talking about this whole process where you can't, you're not in charge even of your own body. You can't make yourself clean or unclean. It happens to you. When you get sick, you're not in control. When you are unclean, you're not in control. So you aren't, he's just pointing that out, the human frailty, the human condition. So don't swear on your own head because you're not really in charge of things the way you think you are. You don't know, you can't control the outcome of what you're saying because you might get sick tomorrow and become impure. There's nothing you can do about that. And so it's a nice little reminder of how, you know, who is it? Rich Mullins, who says, we're not as strong as we think we are. I mean, a lot of times people, you know, when you feel strong, you feel confident. Yeah, I'll do that. I can do it. And then, like, the next day you're sick. You're like, oh. You know, you need that reminder. As humans, we are not in control, even of ourselves, the way we think we are. And we have to be completely dependent on God. So I think that's behind this Matthew passage. But we'll go back to our text, because Matthew wasn't there yet. All right, let me see if I've written down anything else to discuss. I want to move to the Isaiah passage, but let me just ask, is there something that we haven't covered in Leviticus 13 initially that we need to touch on before we continue to Isaiah? Does anyone have a comment?
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Why is beginning of chapter 13 exactly the same as 18 to 28?
I think it's the general category, and then within that there are specific things. Well, what about in this case? And so again, some of these terminologies we may not be able to understand completely, but you know, you have the case of a boil and then a burn, and what are all the instances that could possibly confuse you, or like how would it appear in this case? And so it details it again.
And it's interesting that it's split into two parashot. I mean, that was last week.
Yeah.
And that actually follows on to a whole lot of stuff about the rules and regulations for childbirth and so on.
Yeah.
So now we're getting to the specifics.
Uh-huh. And, okay, and then if you notice in verse 24, what did you have, what was your translation for verse 24?
Well, suppose the body has a burn from fire on its skin, and the raw flesh of the burn becomes...
Raw flesh, that's it. That's how it starts in Hebrew. Or raw flesh, if it's in the skin, in a burn. And so it's dealing with raw flesh. In verse 24. And that seems to be a common denominator that would put you in the impure category, is to have this raw flesh, which maybe is oozing or very red, looks like open.
Exposed.
So it's not dried up, it's not darkened.
What do other people have in what you might call the old-fashioned Bibles? What have you got, Francis, in my old Bible?
Raw flesh.
This is an NIV.
Well, you have this raw flesh.
Raw flesh.
But you're not using that.
In my translation, it looks like it would be... Could you also on the animals? Like anybody?
What have you got?
Ah, any basal, any flesh?
Raw flesh.
But it's... I don't think the animals... Well, the animals need to be unblemished to be a sacrifice, but beyond that, there's no animals bringing another sacrifice. So it would really be in the context of humans that need to know whether they're pure or impure. But I suppose it could be in terms of determining whether an animal is fit for a sacrifice. They would not be able to have something like this on them, for sure.
No, because when you look for a... I didn't hear the question, but when you look for a lamb without spot or without blemish.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it says it all, really.
Yeah.
I mean, and you do get animals with, I don't know, eczema or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what interests me is this this word I put on the board. Now we're going to read Isaiah. That's the only connection I find, except for a metaphorical one. So let's go to Isaiah 57, verses 17. And I don't think any of us would have gotten to Isaiah 57. But it is fascinating to put ourselves in a first century context and think, oh yeah, if I read this passage about these skin diseases, I'd start thinking about Isaiah 57. Very, very interesting. So, if you will humor me, I think we actually need to start reading verse 16. So, why don't we start there? Weber, would you like to start us off since we stopped with you?
17.
Verse 16, and then we'll keep going. I forget when, but just read a verse or two, and then I'll stop you when I think we've read enough.
I will not accuse them forever, nor will I always be angry. For then they would faint away because of the very people I have created.
Go ahead.
I was enraged by a sinful greed. I punished him and hid my face in anger. Yet he kept on in his willful ways. I've seen his ways, but I will heal him. I will guide him and restore comfort to him, creating praise on the lips of the mourners in Israel.
Creating praise? What?
On the lips of the
mourners
in Israel.
Wow. Oh, yeah.
Interesting. And was that verse 19 for you?
That's verse 19.
Very interesting. They've, her translation has combined verse 18 with the beginning of 19.
And the rest of it says, peace, peace to those far and
near. Well, that would be verse 19, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
That's
yes.
The continuation of verse 19. You want me to stop?
Go ahead and finish that verse.
Peace, peace to those far and near, says the Lord, and I will heal them.
All right. Back. Who wants to start? Peter? Amos, do you want to?
But the wicked are like the restless sea, unable to still its waters, tooth up mud and dirt. There is no shalom, says my God, for the wicked.
There's no shalom, yeah. Isn't there, what do you all have for that verse, by the way? Verse 21. Does anyone have, there's no rest?
There's no peace.
There's no peace, no prosperity. What else?
There's no shalom, says Michael.
Yours says no shalom.
Yeah. Well, what have you got in yours, Francis?
Peace.
No peace. So okay. Shalom, but it's shalom in Hebrew.
It's shalom, that's right. Shalom's a Hebrew word. But this translation deemed it so loaded that they didn't want to translate it with any one word, so they gave
right.
you the transliteration.
But it does that all the time.
Okay. So that basically takes us to the end. That's not very many verses. There's a lot of interesting language here. Again, Isaiah, he's one of my favorites, but he is a poet, and a lot of what he says on first read, you don't totally understand. You have to keep mulling over it. And as poetry can be, it can be ambiguous as well. So even when you think you understand it, you always, well, maybe someone else has another explanation. But he's a wonderful poet, and he says, well, I didn't see the word ketzef. Right, but did you find, is ketzef in this original?
No, that's the white hair. I don't know if that was like.
Oh, okay. Like, well, we can discuss. I'll open it up to you. What do you see as connecting these two texts?
Who connected it, by the way?
People in the first century.
Right, but where is that?
Well, you can read the book that we're basing these readings off of, but basically through Geniza's. These were basically popular connections that people made. So more than one person connected these two passages, or it was known to be connected.
I would say that no matter what disease man has, God can heal him.
Okay, so we do have a connection of disease, right? In fact, it doesn't mention disease here, does it? But it mentions healing,
mm-hmm.
which is often a metaphor for salvation. They come together. There's healing, there's salvation. Again, a physical metaphor that works nicely as a spiritual understanding. So how many times does God talk about healing in this passage?
Only once, I think, just that one more time. I've seen his ways, but I will heal him. But then
probably
again,
more.
I will lead him and restore comfort to him and
twice.
His mourners.
I count twice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. End of 19, you're right.
So you got twice in a small amount of verses. That's pretty good.
But restore is like healing.
Well,
oh, is that a different word?
It's the same word in Hebrew. Well, it depends. Where are you reading restore?
Well, I'm reading restore in verse 18. I will guide him and restore comfort to him.
Okay. So before guiding him, what do you have?
I have seen his ways, but I will heal him.
There you go. That's the heal we're talking
yeah.
about. Yeah.
But what is the word for here?
But it also
I will heal him and restore comfort.
Ashalem. Yeah.
Yeah.
I will pay back, or I will recompense comforting.
Verse 19, there is another heal, says, and I will heal them.
Yes, exactly. Verse 19, there's another heal. I will heal them. Okay, so there's this general link. There's the healing. Oh, what happened? I've been leaving this open too much. So if you have healing, that implies that there was something to heal, right? And earlier, Isaiah opens his book with saying what? Do you remember in the first very Isaiah 1? What does he say about Israel? They're sick. They have an open wound from the head to the foot. Like they are completely covered in open wound, which if we look in this passage, means what?
They're
unclean. They're completely unclean. So, of course, Isaiah is using this metaphorically as being full of sin.
Yeah, it's interesting. It says, I have seen his ways and will heal him rather than, like, correct him or punish or, like...
Okay, so Danny brings up in verse 18, it says, his ways I have seen and I will heal him. And so the question is, in the Hebrew, should you say... and I will heal him anyway, or is it, but I will heal him despite seeing his bad ways? Or, as Dat Mikra interprets,
but.
No, he interprets, I've seen his ways that he's repented and I will heal him. So when I see that his ways have been corrected, then I will heal him. But that is reading into it because it doesn't say his evil ways, it just says his ways. And the previous verse implies
that he went on backsliding in the way of his heart.
Okay, so let me ask specifically in verse 17, what is this evil? What are his... what
unjust
is a sin?
Gain.
Sorry?
Unjust gain.
Unjust gain.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Extortion.
Betza. He can't see it anymore. Betzalikain. Betza. Is gain, and it is negatively connotated word. The implication is you've gained material wealth in some kind of way that's either oppressive to other people or somehow unjust.
I have flagrant greed.
Flagrant greed. Okay. It literally says the iniquity of his gain. Or you could say his unjust gain, if you write in the implication. That's what's made God mad. So in the greater context, what's interesting to me is that God has just finished saying, I'm not going to be angry forever. Right? I'm going to make the lowly in spirit, I'm going to make them live. And I'm going to make the crushed or the depressed heart, I'm going to make them live. Because I'm not going to come against you forever, legally. I'm not going to be angry forever. Because if he were, then the spirit would wrap itself. And that's a hard word to translate. Either it would faint or would be no more.
There are passages like this in that where there's sin and then there's recompense. Like there's
mm-hmm.
there's you know, consequences.
Right.
Or there's, you know, there's consequence and then there's repentance. But then there's plenty of passages where God is like, I've beat you up for too long.
Right.
And now I just feel sorry for you.
I gotta give you a break, because if I didn't, you would die.
Yeah.
It's kind of like after the flood, he says, I'm not going to completely wipe you out anymore. So he has this vow not to completely wipe you out, even though you would deserve it.
Yeah. They still haven't done anything to...
Right, they still haven't really necessarily repented.
Well, it's interesting that in Matthew 5, it says, blessed are the poor in spirit. They have to be made lowly in order to...
Right. And so this is my connecting word, which isn't actually even in our verse, but immediately precedes it. It's this low of spirit. And it uses the same word for low, but now instead of flesh, it's spirit. To be low of spirit, meaning to be humble. And so... It is in verse 15, yes. And then God points out, you know, I have to be kind to the people I've made.
Yeah, but he says on one hand he won't be angry forever. And then he says, but because of the iniquity of his unjust gain, I was angry, I struck him, I hid my face. And
mm-hmm.
it says again, I was angry, but he went on backsliding in the way of his heart.
Well, the question is this whole passage we're reading, is it a specific, like after he's given this general thing, I'm not going to be angry forever, but for this, this is the biggest thing I'm looking at. So if you do this, I'm going to be angry. Or is it, that was the case, and now I'm just angry again? Do you see what I'm saying? This Dat Mikra takes it as a specific thing. So in general, I'm going to restore you. I see you can't take it. You're human, and you just keep messing up. But the biggie that you will be punished for is Betza. And if that's the understanding, it's very interesting because you think, you know, the big sins, you think kind of obvious, like murder, adultery, and yet God's big sin is selfish gain, like you gaining at the expense of someone else. It's much more subtle.
Isn't it like the Tenth Commandment?
It's similar in that, well, we have don't steal and we have don't...
Covet.
Right, but it would be more of an implication from that. None of the words directly connects it to the Ten Commandments.
But what you're saying is that the word, I've lost it actually, Sharon. I've lost the link now with Leviticus.
The link that I see is this lower, this humble spirit, using this word of shafal.
Oh, wow.
Shafal ruach in verse 15. That God is going to bring to life those that are humble in spirit. What do you have?
Well,
contrived and lowly spirit.
That I dwell in an exalted and holy place, but also with the discouraged and humiliated, is the NET translation. In order to cheer up the humiliated and to encourage the discouraged. For I will not be hostile forever or perpetually angry. For then man's spirit would grow faint before me, the life-giving breath I created.
But it was because of the iniquity of his unjust gain that I got so actually mad. That was so terrible. So the link in some is really just a verbal link between this disease, which...
The link is possibly a poetic link with this
right.
word of being humble or mm-hmm. lower. And Isaiah, throughout his book, talks about, uses this metaphor of lower as a humble image. He has shval einaim in other places that he contrasts with pride.
But is this shval einaim or something linked in some way with the shval of the so-called leprosy or the boil?
Well,
or
it's the same word as these places. But interestingly, in Leviticus 13, it's one of the indicators of being impure.
Okay, so the pride makes you impure.
No,
unclean.
No. The humbleness makes you realize that you're impure and in need of help. I think he's using it as ironic metaphor of like the people who are humble are those that understand that they need the help. And those are the ones he's going to give life to.
It seems a bit of a stretch. I think I'm more convinced by the healing, which implies clearly the need for it.
Okay.
The healing in this passage, which is, if you like, in contrast to the flawed state of humanity.
Right.
The Lord, he offers healing almost without reason, you know, despite how we are.
Sure, because, however, there is no direct reference in this selection to healing. And many times when we read through these, we find poetic links as well. And usually you find several strands. So let's say the overall context of healing may connect you up. Within that, there can still be secondary links that connect you up. Because again, you have to think of the person reading in the original language. And some of these words to you might look distant. But when you're hearing shafal and shafal, why wouldn't you connect them?
That's the thing that we've lost because
we're not reading in the language.
The Bible is poetry, and so
at a minimalistic understanding.
So people in those days and Jesus' days are thinking in poetic terms constantly, and so they're connecting the words first, not necessarily the context or the theme or even the meaning. And the meaning comes later. It'll come attached. And Jesus does that too. He'll combine two verses in a poetic way.
Absolutely.
And it's the poetry that's at the heart of it. And you can't see that unless you see the Hebrew. It has its strongest punch. In Hebrew. But we in Protestantism. Also, because we also think much more on theological terms rather than in poetic and in other terms,
yeah.
Don't value it or miss it.
Well,
and Jenny, it's not just Protestantism, or whatever that is. It's also we've lost that poetic bit because if you think of some of Shakespeare. Or not the Bible, but English connections. And even in some of the ditties that one sings, there are words that play on words.
Yeah, of course.
And you can laugh at it, you can see what it is,
yeah.
But you don't see what's lying underneath it very often. It's got some historical connotation, it's got whatever.
Uh-huh.
So I think it happens all the time. When you lose the words in any language... You stop thinking about what they mean. And in English,
right.
We're very lazy.
Well, it's not just that. Most of us here are not reading the Hebrew. We're not reading the original
right.
language. And in poetry, we all know not the double nature behind the language, the sounds, they don't translate.
Right.
And so we necessarily lose the poetry. We can't help it because we're not reading in the original.
Right.
And so it's not that we don't want to see it. We don't see it. And so that leads us down this path instead of seeing connections where they may be.
Well, Hebrew poetry, in a way, is almost the most translatable form of poetry because it's a repetition of thought.
Well, not completely.
Well, I know, but that's a standout characteristic of the poetry. Same thing two, three, or four times.
Sure, there are parallelisms, and it's nice to repeat a thought. Even it's nice to repeat the same word, which in English we actually try to shy away from. It's considered nice in our ears to say the same thing without using the same word.
In grammar school, you are told expressly not to use the same word.
Right, to the point where it's confusing reading articles because you get to another word that's a synonym. Now, are you making a differentiation here, or are you continuing the same thought? But that's not Hebrew. Hebrew likes to repeat words. But we're talking about more of things like shafal, like in any language, that can be used in two contexts that are very different, but there's a connection simply because people know that word. And when you hear that word, your brain has links to all those contexts. And so it can actually make very creative couplings of texts that you're not able to do if you don't know that word and all those links.
To me, the broader context is the provision that God has made for our sin. The priest, even the fact that there is a priest, was his provision, which was to be Yeshua. And it's that he's prepared to get involved in this nitty-gritty of is it white, is it lower, has it got a hair, you know.
The provision part is interesting, because the word the priest will look, or it will be shown to the priest. And I was thinking, we were recently reading Genesis 22, the binding of Isaac, and at the end of the story it says, because on Har Moriah it will be shown, literally. And it's translated, it will be provided. And so that sense of God has a provision. He has a salvation. He has a way of dealing with it. That's also a nice thematic connection. I will also say, though, back to verse 17, some things in your translation that are smoothed over aren't so clear. One being the tense of the verbs. I was angry. Is this, it says katsafti, which can be used as I hereby am angry, or I was angry. And in this context, it's a little bit confusing because right afterwards it says, ve'akehu, and I will strike him. So what, you were angry and you will strike him, or you were angry and you struck him? And all your translations have done what?
I've got past tense. I was angry, I struck him, I hid my face, I was angry.
There you go. And that's what this guy interprets as well. But just so you know, there is, when you're reading it, you feel this, whoa, what's going on here? What are the tenses doing? I got a past and a future right there together, but they seem to be two parts.
Where's the future?
Akehu, I will strike him.
But what's that? Where is that in the verse?
Will strike.
Will strike him.
I struck him. I struck him, but you've got it in a future tense.
Well, it literally says, and I will strike him. But the question is this some type of poetic, rhetorical coupling of two verbs?
Right.
Is that in verse 17?
It's in verse 17, yes. And actually it continues. And then, and I will strike him haster. So hiding, and the implication is hiding my face. And then you have to interpret that image. Well, what does this mean? You know, is it because he's hiding his face that he can strike him? Because if he were looking at him, he'd have too much mercy and not be able to strike him.
And then in verse 18, they choose to go with future there, even though it's the same thing.
Yeah. So the same thing happening again. His ways I have seen, and I will heal him. So in this place, in 18, as Danny pointed out, they've taken it as future. Not as I healed him, but I will heal him. And I will set him, direct him in the way, and I will repay him with comfort.
So the will, the will in 18 is all an addition. I mean, it's not really.
No. What the Hebrew, the literal words, the tense of the words in 17 and 18, there are two verbs that are in the future tense. And the question is how to understand them. So the first is understood as a past tense because of its context. And the second is understood as a future.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, you're
you can go either way with them.
So you have to allow for some ambiguity, is what I'm saying. That you're not feeling in your translated text because you're not seeing it. But it is there. You're kind of like, whoa, what's it doing there? What does it mean, I will strike him? Oh, I struck him by hiding my face. Another funny one for those who speak modern Hebrew. He went shovav. Today, we call just kids that are kind of being mischievous and cute, you know, is a shovav. But here, it's a much more serious thing. It's really to be rebellious, to go away from God, away from his path, and to just walk
in our
way. That's verse 17 still.
Oh, that's turn 17.
So,
where's our shovav here?
Last line of,
verse 17.
Oh, he went on backsliding in the way of his heart. They were shovavim.
He went on backsliding in the way of his heart. We have a lot of other contexts. I can throw some out at you. That if people just walk in their own way, they basically mess themselves up. It's this concept of God doesn't need to punish us. He just has to let us walk in our own way, and we're going to end up punishing ourselves.
He kept on in his willful ways.
Right. So compare Deuteronomy 32:20. Really quick. Let's go there. Okay. Here God says, Vayomer astira fanai, and I said, I will hide my face from them, and I will see what their future will be. Because they are a mixed up generation. They are children that have no fidelity in them. So, ooh, wow.
Is this upside down generation?
Wait, do you have in verse 20, I will reject them?
I will hide my face from them.
I like that better. I kind of, in this case, I would say keep the metaphor and let people understand it. If you say reject, that's a little different than hiding your face from somebody. So the link here is, that metaphor of hiding your face. In our context, in Isaiah 57, it doesn't actually say your face. It just says hiding, and the implication is hiding of the face. But you see the same kind of idea.
Says, I hid my face.
Where? In your verse 17. In Hebrew, it doesn't say the face. That's been supplied for you in the translation to help you understand the metaphor. But the original text just says hiding. Like from this word lehastir, to hide.
I hardly read any of these things that we read before with so many differences of words in the translations and in the Hebrew as well. But like when people are reading, it's like wrong verse. I must be in the wrong place. I've never seen so much difference.
Well, again, you know, we're dealing with poetry, and it's hard to translate poetry. I mean, I was just at a conference for Bible translation, and it's with fear and trembling that you try to translate the Bible, because there are so many ways that you could mess up. In so many places, you're forced to make a decision. And which way do you go? Do you leave it a metaphor? Do you try to explain the metaphor? Because you think if you don't, that people will interpret it wrongly. There's such a weight, you know.
And even when you come out of the metaphorical thing, I mean, you know, how do you translate Schelling snow in the middle of whatever?
Right, sure, people who don't understand
and
snow.
There's a whole thing somewhere. One of the translators is telling me they don't have goats, or they don't have sheep, or they don't have something. I can't remember.
Or just snow itself.
They don't have bread.
And there's dynamic equivalents.
Yeah.
The only thing you have to remember is that some of these texts are not understandable on the first read. And part of it is reading it and reading it and reading it. And being taught about it, and then your understanding grows. So even with translation, you don't have to feel like you have to explain it completely on your first read, or else you might be adding in much more than you should. Because even when we read in English, we have to think about it. Like, even after the translations have been smoothing things out for you, you're still pondering, you know, what does this mean? What is this metaphor? And as you do, there's so much more that comes to light. But
I was
here,
just thinking about this thing about hiding your face, when the great blessing is that the Lord will lift up the light of his countenance, his face upon us, and give us his peace. It's the same poetic construct.
When I struck him, I hid his face. And okay, so we're kind of out of time, but one of the other huge connectors I see is this whole part of Isaiah. He goes in and out of Israel as talking about Israel as a single person. And he also talks about his servant. And there is interpretation about a leprous Messiah, a suffering servant. And in one of them, it's a Messiah that actually has this skin disease, has leprosy, or what we've been acquainted to hearing as leprosy. And so this idea that taking on this humility, taking on this disease, to then be raised up and to be healed. And it's very interesting, because I was wondering if maybe that was between the connection as well. This, that the humble will be raised up, and the humble are going to be healed. And this sense that we brought up earlier, that God, he recognizes that we're all in so much need of healing. Without him, we would all perish. So he's going to provide the healing, even while they're in their rebellious state. And I think that connects us to a lot of places in the New Testament as well. But this whole concept of hiding my face, you know, it kind of reminds you of Jesus on the cross and saying, you know, why have you forsaken me? That kind of thing as well. But maybe I'll just leave us with a challenge. Again, what I said at the very beginning, that of all the iniquities that make God angry, which one is he zeroing in on? Oppression, or putting yourself up at the expense of putting other people down. And betza is a very practical thing. We're talking about money here. We're not talking about some abstract sense of how people feel. It's money. And I think that's something we can all take away with, that God cares about our motivations regarding money, and he cares about the things that you can't necessarily prove, but that he knows. Like, if we are prospering at the expense of someone else, he's going to see it, and it's going to make him angry. And it will evoke some punishment. So this, all in these several verses, we have this beautiful picture of what really makes God angry, and that he knows we're human, and he's already supplied healing for us in that state. But for those, if you read the very end, it's for those who actually repent. Another thing we didn't get to, you can ponder, for those near and far. Did you remember that part? And what does that remind you of?
Israel and the other nations.
Israel and the other nations. In Ephesians 2:17, that in Jesus God has joined those who were far away and those who were near. And then the question is, in the original context, what that meant. Those far away implies that they've stumbled off on their own path, but not necessarily that they were trying to be evil. Again, it's just a consequence of not being close to God and choosing the wrong path. So they could still have a repentant heart in some way. So I was thinking about it, that there's a difference between being lost and being downright evil. But anyway, something to ponder, the near and the far. And we're going to have to make our way down to worship service now, because our time's up, but Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you
very much. Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom.
Enjoy his peace.
Chodesh Tov.
Chodesh Tov.
We celebrate it.